Here's something that'll shock you. The BC Liberal Party receives more in political donations from mining companies than the citizens of BC earn in direct revenues from mining. Here's something else that will shock you. The BC government has introduced legislation that will allow the minister responsible to enter into secret agreements with oil and gas companies without cabinet approval. Joining us to talk about these issues is our regular monthly guest, Norm Farrell, the author of the blog Northern Insight. Norm, good to talk to you again.
It's good to be back, Ian.
Now, tell us the details about how much money goes into the Liberal Party as opposed to how much the public receives from mining of minerals and metals.
Well, I think we should probably focus on what the public revenues are. Those are fairly apparent from the budget documents and so on. But it takes a fair bit of work to actually extract from the information. When I first started looking at the returns from the natural gas industry many months ago, an individual in government got in touch with me and he said I was on the right track, but what I should be looking at is the mining sector, because in his opinion that's where the real abuses were occurring. And fairly recently I started looking at the underlying documents, and I've discovered in 2013 that there were $7 billion worth of production in the province of metals and minerals, but the province received next to nothing by way of revenue from these metals and minerals. Looking at the current year, the government is forecasting the receipt of $83 million in revenues from metals, minerals, and other materials. The surprising thing, though, is that if you look at the tax credits that they allow individuals and corporations for investing in mining, those exceed $114 million. So there's a $30-odd million loss in terms of the revenues, and that doesn't include the program expenditures, where the government is spending tens of millions of dollars on developing mining activities elsewhere.
So, Norm, just for the sake of so I understand this, we get $83 million in revenues, according to this fiscal year, from the mining of minerals and metals.
Right.
But tax credits are $114 million. So we're giving the mining companies more money than they are giving us.
That's right. The mining companies and the investors in those mining companies who are earning tax credits and able to deduct those from taxes they might otherwise pay.
So according to your numbers, the tax credits, we're losing $41 million.
Yeah, $31
million. $31. That's why I'm not an accountant, because I can't add.
In the current year. So, but that's not all of it, though, because we're spending massive sums elsewhere to facilitate the mining industry. For example, the Northwest Transmission Line that BC Hydro was putting in, when it was first announced, it was said to be a $400 million project. And the current year's budget documents indicate that the actual cost is between the original Northwest Power Line and the what they call the Iskut extension is now almost $1 billion. So, and according to Rich Coleman, that investment was made so that they could supply power to the Red Chris mine.
Mm-hmm.
That's a mine that's owned by Imperial Metals, which was the company which also owned the property that had the
Mount Polley disaster.
That's correct.
Yeah. So we're spending a lot of money to help the mining companies, but the mining companies in return are giving us very little. It reminds me of a story that Mitch Anderson wrote in the Tyee, and I'm going to be talking to Mitch on Friday at 1 o'clock. He talked about the difference between Norway and Alberta, and I just want to give these figures because they're astounding. In 2013, Norway received over $87 in revenue from a barrel of oil. Alaska got over $38, and Alberta got $4.38. We are just giving away our resources in this country.
Now, when Norway decided that they were going to actually assess taxation on against the natural gas and oil production, they were told by the industry that it just wouldn't work, that the whole thing would shut down and everybody would go away and Norway would get nothing. They would lose the activity that they presently had. Well, that turned out not to be at all the case. And the value of the, we should say that the other thing that Norway did was to say that we shouldn't be spending this money to lower current taxes and we should invest this for the future. And so they now have an investment fund that's worth about $1 trillion Canadian. And that's from the natural resource revenue. Alberta, which has been producing oil for decades, has a fund that's worth about $17 billion. British Columbia has a fund of zero, although it does have a promise that it's going to have massive amounts in the future. The premier had indicated that there was as much as $260 billion going to come in over 30 years. Now that 3 years has gone by, and of course nothing is there. But what's interesting is that in the next 3 years, the government is expecting not to receive much in the way of net natural gas revenues again. So we will be 6 years into the 30-year program that promised the $160 billion of government revenue, and we'll have had substantially zero.
Zero. And I think you had a clock on your website, didn't you, which indicated how much money should be in that that pot by now?
That's correct. If you look at the accrual of that amount of money over 30 years, I think since the announcement was made, we're pushing close to $20 billion that should have come in by now if it had were coming in on a straight line basis.
Yeah, well, it was an election promise that was built on a lie. And
and they knew it was a lie as well.
Yeah. Why do we insist, Norm, I don't know whether you can answer this or not, but why do we insist on giving away our resources in this country?
I believe it really has to do with the influence that the particular industries have developed. And you touched on that at the beginning when you talked about the amount of money, which is measured in the millions, that have been donated to the BC Liberal Party by the people involved in the gas and industry, the land development industry, the mining industry. It's very substantial. And I think that if we're ever going to remove the potential for corruption of where natural resources are simply going to be given away to the person who contributes the most to the party in power, then we're going to have to change the election financing. There's a certain degree of transparency today. It's incomplete because there are many ways of putting money through that where the actual donors are not revealed. But in my view, that we have to consider spending limits and public financing of elections.
I mean, it just doesn't make sense that we have our natural resources, our mines and our minerals, which belong to all the people of British Columbia, and yet for somehow allowing the mining companies the privilege of extracting those resources, we owe them $31 million.
Well, it's insane. It's going to grow worse, too, because the Supreme Court decisions have made it clear that the First Nations people cannot be excluded from the values harvested from the lands that they lay claim to.
Yeah.
And so the province has made agreements with a variety of First Nations bands that they're going to be sharing the revenues derived from mining activities on those lands. Now, it may be that the First Nations people are going to be surprised how little they get from that, but whatever amounts are available for distribution are going to have to be shared fairly significantly with the First Nations. So the province of BC, despite the fact that it's spending hugely on infrastructure and various policy programs, is going to be getting even a lower share of the resource values.
I'm going to take a little commercial break a little later because I want to get Jack in so he doesn't have to wait. Jack, welcome to the program.
Thanks. I just wanted to make a comment about the role of the media in all of this, because one of the reasons this carries on and on and on is because nobody ever knows about it because it never gets reported. And that's, of course, because of the very, very close ties between the ownership of all the media in Canada and all the big business. Because it's not only the mining industry. I'm sure many, many industries get these same breaks and better breaks. And Canadians would be outraged if this was big news. But it never is news, except thank you for covering it on this show.
Oh, thank you, Jack. I appreciate it. Any comment on that, Norm?
Well, I think he's certainly correct. I think when you look at the work that the various newspapers are doing, they rely so heavily on sponsorship of the resource companies that they won't touch the kind of material that I've been publishing on my website.
Yep. Norm Farrell is our guest. When we come back, Norm, I want to talk about this mysterious Miscellaneous Statutes Amendment Act. Our guest is Norm Farrell. He is the author of the blog Northern Insight.
Engaging talk. It's the Ian Jessup Show.
Welcome back. Norm Farrell is our guest. He's a regular on this program every month. He has the blog Northern Insight, which is always filled with useful information. And Norm goes through the numbers. And as you heard in the first segment of the program, we give the mining companies $31 million just to extract our minerals and metals. And here's something else I want to talk about, Norm, which you posted on your website. I can't recall seeing it anywhere in the media. It was in what's known as the Miscellaneous Statutes Amendment Act, which the government throws in stuff that it doesn't want really the public to know about. And there's an amendment which allows the minister responsible to enter into agreements with the oil and gas companies. These are actually secret agreements without cabinet approval, and they will not be subject to the Freedom of Information and Privacy Act. Explain that to our listeners.
I don't think I can offer a proper explanation, but in reading through Bill 23 that is entitled the Miscellaneous Statutes Amendment Act, and it was presented by Susan Anton, the Minister of Justice, I was surprised at some of the elements. A part of it is just simple housekeeping that one expects in omnibus bills, but they have stuck in some surprising clauses that I think have really an important, or potentially can be very important over time. Part of it is, I think, they've been pushed by the people they've been negotiating with on LNG to create an environment that won't change over time. So these people say that we worry about if our friendly liberals no longer are the government, that somebody else will come here and expect us to pay things like property taxes and so on. So they want to be able to create agreements that will last for up to 25 years that allow them to escape the potential of change by future governments. And this is going to result or can arise from the minister making agreements in secret that don't have to even go before the cabinet for approval, which I think is questionable in terms of whether that would stand up in court. But it's surprising that the government would be so interested in maintaining this all of the negotiations and the agreements that are being made in an effort to push the gas industry forward. The government wants to keep those secret, and the public interest is only served if there's fairly complete disclosure of those items.
I was reading also a piece that by Andrew Weaver, who wrote something on this called A Multi-Generational Sellout, in which he says this secret agreement doesn't even have to be revealed to cabinet. one which I found very, very strange. Another thing that you have on your website is that oil refineries operated by Chevron and Husky be designated as, quote, not an oil and gas activity.
That is surprising, isn't it?
I don't know what that means.
Well, you can bet that it will have some import, otherwise it wouldn't be there. Now,
yeah.
The kind of situations that I can imagine is relief from environmental regulations. That's a possibility. It may be related to local taxation. I don't know, and it's not disclosed, and from what I've read of the debates, I haven't seen anything, any explanation of that at all. So, as I say, there's a lack of transparency on these things. I think the whole oil and gas industry initiatives ought to be separated from ordinary housekeeping work so that they can be looked at, debated appropriately. If they're going to just try and slip through changes that have potential to devastate the economy in the future, then we ought to know about it, and we ought to be discussing it.
And Normie, you should be ashamed of yourself for saying that the Christy Clark government is doing this in secret, because she said she'd have the most open government anywhere in Canada.
They've been promising that, I think, since approximately 2001, which is when they were elected, and they were complaining about the lack of transparency of the preceding government. And that was a major part of their initial campaign. They've, of course, failed to live up to it in spades.
Norm, the issue of BC Ferries and fare increases, has that blown over now? Is it no longer an issue as far as the public is concerned?
You know, I think every time I get on a ferry, it becomes an issue that's important to me.
Yeah.
And I'm surprised, to be honest, that it receives as little traction as it does. You know, if you look at the treatment of the coastal ferry consumers and the users of ferries in the interior, it's amazing, really. The government has tended to downplay that interior ferry situation, saying, "Oh well, it's these are long-standing agreements, and they're really not substantial cost to the public," and so on. So I decided to look at what was being paid to the operators of these inland ferries. And in 2013 and 2014, I counted $72 million paid to two companies that are the main operators. Now, there are four other of these inland ferry operators, but they also are being paid for road maintenance work and so on, so it's impossible to separate out the cost of those ferry services. But as I say, between the Waterbridge equipment, Waterbridge ferries, and Western Pacific Marine, there were $72 million paid out in 2013 and 2014. Now, if you look at the number of local, I calculated that if a person were using the Campbell River Quadra Island ferry once a week, they would pay about, for a car and driver and one passenger, they'd pay about $1,400 a year. That's a 10-minute ferry ride. And if you're looking at using the Kootenay Bay to Balfour ferry ride, which is 35 minutes on an 80-car ferry, the cost would be zero. And Kootenay Bay to Balfour actually has a land-based alternative road, so it's quicker to use the ferry, but if the ferry wasn't there, people could still make the trip.
Yeah.
So the principles that are applied in terms of cost recovery on the coastal ferries is just completely thrown overboard on the inland ferries.
Norm, we have to run now. 2:30 news. Appreciate it. We'll talk to you again in several weeks.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. That's Norm Farrell of the blog Northern Insight. When we come back, we're going to talk to John.